My name is Brad Price. I want to welcome you to this Bible study in Revelation chapter 12. We're about halfway through the book, and we're so glad that you've joined us. We have our regular two teachers, Lonnie Woodruff and Ivy Connor, with us. We're going to read Revelation chapter 12, only going down through verse 6. And after that's done, we're going to turn things over to Ivy and let him take a look through the text, and then we will go through it probably about two verses at a time. Starting with Revelation 12, 1, the text says, "And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child or pregnant, and she crieth out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered." And there was, as we get down to verse 3, well, we're going to have to make a quick adjustment there. "And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems or crowns. Verse 4, and his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven, and it casts them to the earth. And the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. And she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God. And there they may nourish her 1,260 days." That's our reading. We're now going to turn things over to Ivy.
Okay, well, that was quick. That was quick, Brad. Yeah, we have had some discussion about this in our prep for the show here tonight, or for the, our study. And in Revelation chapter 12, we've got two signs here. A sign that appeared in heaven of a great woman that's a huge woman and beautiful and bright. And then in verse 3, there's another sign in heaven, that of a great dragon. So you've got the godly sign of this woman, and then you've got the dragon that's going to try to come in and disrupt things. And this, we leave the outward, we call it, and most of the scholars would have picked up on this too, and I just simply tag along. Chapter 1 through 11 is the outer struggle. We're seeing the church and the world fighting together. The church, basically, and Rome is precisely the one here in Revelation, as the history of the time is. The seven churches, the milieu, are the history of the time in which they lived. That was what was going on. And so then we go to we come to chapter 12 and to 22. Then we've got another look. We've got a look at the inward pride, or the more spiritual side. We had the outward sign of the battle of the church and the world, and now we have the battle is between God and Satan, and particularly between Christ and Satan, and that's what I see developing here. Really, the book ends at 11, victory in Jesus. Jesus has won. He's beat the devil in that series. Now we're going to take a closer look inwardly and see really what's going on. Much more symbolism, a lot of excitement here, and it just really makes sense. It gels together for me. A great sign, not just a sign. Now, a sign, the word Simeon means a sign or wonder that pointed to something that was spiritual. Like in the Gospel of John, Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. But the symbol was, I am the resurrection of the life. And though you die, yet shall you live. And he raises Lazarus, the symbolism. So these, it wasn't that Lazarus lived. It was what that indicated. It pointed to the deity of Jesus. And so this great sign in heaven about this man child, about this woman, and then delivering a man child is symbolic of something more than just the birth of a great character. It's a great wonder. And then you've got it again in verse 3, another sign appeared in heaven, and that of the great red dragon. And, you know, just to show the book of Revelation, the Bible tells us what these signs are, and the Bible tells us here what it means, and we let the Bible interpret the Bible. We don't go out here into wild kind of, call it newspaper theology and futurism, but we let the Bible explain itself. So in 15:1, again, it says, "And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous." He's saying this is symbolism. It's not in reality. So as we look at this, and as I kind of try to scope this quickly here tonight, the great sign appeared in heaven. It's a woman clothed with the sun and all of that. And she has a crown upon her head of 12 stars. 12, we've learned, is representation of God's people on earth. In Old Testament, it's the 12 tribes of Israel. And in the New Testament, the 12 apostles are in the foundation of the church, with Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. I think that's about Ephesians 2:20. But anyway, he says that that this woman has a child, and she's about to deliver. She's like 11 months pregnant. I mean, that's very pregnant. No, she's ready to go, 9 months long or however, ready to give birth. And this other sign he sees in heaven, behold, a great red dragon, not a small one, not a little one, not a nice pretty one, a blue one or a green one, but a great red dragon. And the red, as we know from the seals that we broke, the second seal was that of the rider on the red horse, which is persecution and death. This dragon, the great red dragon, is bad. He's evil. He's weird. Who is he? Well, we don't know yet. But whoever he is, he's after Jesus. He's after the woman who's going to deliver the child. And the woman, he says, he had seven heads, and he had 10 horns. And on his heads were seven diadems, not Stephanos, but diadems. And I think somebody will probably make a point of that. If not, we'll all work together on that. Verse 4, his tail swept away a third part of the heaven. Now, friends, if you got a big dragon, he's really big. He wags his tail. Billions of stars fall from heaven. Thousands, millions of stars fall. He wags his tail. A third of the stars. That's not literal. Be careful when you get into this prophecy, making it mean something else. It's just a lot of stars. He's big. And he stood before the woman who was about to give birth. He wants that child. The dragon does. She's about to give birth so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. He wants Christ gone. He wants this woman, whoever he is, at this one we really don't know yet. But she gave birth to a son, a male child. That's a double down positive. He not just was a male, he was a real man, or a real man. Here's someone, really somebody. A son, a male child, grateful it wasn't a female. A bit bad at this time, wouldn't it, the prophecy of Jesus? You understand how incredibly accurate and incredibly wonderful it is to study this prophecy and see the wisdom of the Bible and the power of what we have here in this revelation. Revelation is an awesome book. He says this man child is going to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. That's not the devil. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. We learn it in Psalm 2. We learn it in Revelation chapter 19 and in other places here. This child comes and he's going to rule the world with the rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Now, wait a minute. What happened? This devil is there. This dragon, whoever the dragon is there, waiting on this woman to deliver. She's very pregnant. She's got the sun behind her, the moon under her feet. She's huge. The devil is huge. He wags his tail. Third of the star. He's powerful. He's going to be able to get that child, just a little baby, going to get that child. And so when the woman is delivered, the man child, he's called up immediately to God and to his throne. And that means God wins. And Jesus wins. Then the woman fled into the wilderness when she had a place prepared by God, and that she would be nourished for 1,260 days. That's time protection. We've already studied this in the first half of the book. That's the time protection God's taking care of. It's not the end of the world. It's the first half, 3.5 years. I mean, that's the symbolism. It's not a complete time, incomplete time. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the angels and the dragon and his angels waged war. Okay, so we find out that the dragon is Satan. Satan is after the child. The child is delivered, and he is then raised by God. Our God, not after 3 days and three nights, not after a lifetime. It's immediate. It's a picture of victory. This devil is trying to get the church. This devil is trying to get us, God's bride, but he doesn't succeed because she is resurrected and ascends into heaven. And the devil sits there with seven heads warning that baby and goes away without any victory at all. God has the victory. That's what I see there, fellas.
All right, Ivy, very good. Thank you so much. Why don't I give you a shot at the first two verses, and then I'll go back through them as well, and maybe Ivy will want to jump back in here too. But where he talks about the great sign in heaven, the woman arrayed with the sun, the moon under her feet, the crown of 12 stars, and travailing, ready to give birth. Some things that you'd like to add there.
Okay. I think the woman clothed with the sun, first of all, obviously it was a glorious thing there, the sun. the moon under her feet, and a head, a garland of 12 stars. This is the fantastic lady, so to speak. She is arrayed in all manner of things that are bright. And she has 12 stars. And I think the number there, the 12, is very telling about the woman, because the number 12 is the number that God used to organize his people. In the Old Testament, he organized his people in 12 tribes. And in the New Testament, he taught the world the gospel, or brought the world to the gospel to the world through the 12 apostles. So this indicates to me that this is talking about, I think it's talking about Israel. And then Revelation 12:2 says, then she being with child, she cried out in labor and pain to give birth. There's really only two options here. This lady being pictured here had to either be Israel, or it had to be the mother of Jesus, the physical mother of Jesus, who was Mary. And says she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. So I think we have to be very careful when we make these things in Revelation physical, literal events. Revelation uses symbols to describe things. It uses physical symbols to describe things that are spiritual in nature. Now, this, I'll review that in just a second, but let me read you a passage here out of the Old Testament about the labor, the lady, the woman being in labor and paining to give birth. Now, before I do that, I want to reiterate the fact that we have two genealogies of Jesus. We have the genealogy coming through Joseph and the genealogy coming through Mary. It was very important at that time that the genealogies, that the people in Israel kept their genealogies. And the reason for it was because Jesus was going to come from the nation of Israel. Yeah. He was going to be born an Israelite. And so we have that proof in that way. And I'd like to go back and read Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8. I'll start with verse 7, and this is kind of a rhetorical question in verse 7. Before she was in labor, she gave birth. Before pain came, she was delivered with a, she delivered a male child. And then in verse 66, 8, he says, who has heard such of a thing? Well, we haven't heard such a thing. We don't give, children are not born before the mother goes into labor and gives birth. And that's what he's saying here. And he says, then in 66:8 going on down, he says, shall the earth be made to give birth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? Okay, it's telling us it takes time for these things to take place. And then it says, for as soon as Zion, that's got to be Israel, was in labor, she gave birth to her children. So I think what we're seeing here in verse 2 is that this woman represented the nation of Israel. She was going to give birth to Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He was going to come through the nation of Israel. She had the 12 stars. And then in verse 2, she being with child, she cried out in labor and pain to give birth. So Israel pained in labor to give birth to Jesus Christ, since he was coming to this world through the nation of Israel. Okay, Brad.
All right. Thank you very much. Going back to one of the great points that Ivy made a little bit ago, as far as the greatness of the sign, I think that you see that greatness also emphasized by the sun and the moon. It's like John 1, 2, 3, multiple expressions of the greatness. And truly it was great. You also may have reflected here when you think about the sun and the moon, light. When you look at the Old Testament system, Mary had a little light. There are a lot of people under the Old Testament. They got snippets. They got snatches of that light, so much that by the time you get to Luke chapter 2, verses 25 and 38, there were people who were looking for the Messiah. They had some sense. They didn't understand everything, just like Peter talks about the angels, but they knew that something probably was on the horizon, and they were looking and presumably praying for God's help. As you think about maybe you're married, or maybe you've seen a lady progress through a pregnancy and different things unfold. A lot of times a lady who's pregnant, there are things that come up that she's not anticipating. Maybe there are health concerns or other things where I didn't expect that to happen to me. When you look at God's plan for redemption in the Old Testament, and I'll give some more examples of this a little bit later, but there were a lot of twists and turns. If you study through the Old Testament and you look at it from the standpoint of redemption, you're thinking, all right, things are finally moving along pretty well, but all of a sudden it looks like, oh, hey, this happened, or it looks like a key person was going to be killed. But God had everything under control. He is on the throne, and Ivy and Lonnie have done a good job as far as making that point time and time again. One of the things that hasn't been brought out yet, when you look at the word pain in these first two verses, it's a word which is also used in Matthew chapter 14 and verse 24 to describe torture at the end of time. Here it is used of intensive bodily pain. Now, don't want to go too far with that. You can really go far afield in the book of Revelation, but it's one more way, and certainly nothing is too hard for God. Nothing is painful for God in the sense of pain as we think about the word, but it is a word which I think helps describe that the process that God used, whether you look at this from the standpoint of Mary, whether you look at this as far as what God did with Old Testament Israel, this was a painstaking process. And God, the whole Bible, it's that golden thread of redemption that weaves through scripture from the beginnings in Genesis all the way through the last chapter in Revelation, that God was doing something very special. He was going to bring the church into the world, and the devil is there, as Ivy mentioned earlier, pictured as someone who wants to pounce. But in spite of all the roadblocks, in spite of Satan's desire to stop things, when the fullness of time came, Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, Jesus was sent into the world. Some have said that the Old Testament is pregnant with messianic hope. I like that description, especially when you look at what we have here in Revelation chapter 12. Jesus was sent into the world, John 3 and verse 16. We've got John the Baptist announcing information about Jesus, Mark chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. And it's not going to be that long before Christmas comes up. You're going to have some denominational preachers who get into pulpits, and they're going to tell some things about December and Jesus' birth that are simply not found in Scripture. If you wanted to preach about the Lord's birth, well, try Revelation chapter 12. You don't have any information about a baby in a manger, shepherds rejoicing, or wise men bringing gifts and worshiping. You've got the devil pictured there ready to pounce. That would be some quote-unquote Christmas sermon. When you look at John's description for the New Testament church, he uses feminine terms as far as this pregnant woman bringing forth Jesus. And that's not surprising. In fact, when you start looking at the New Testament, you have the New Testament church described oftentimes with feminine imagery. Think about the image that Paul uses in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 through 31. He compares the church to husbands and wives. And then in Ephesians 5 and verse 32, he says, this mystery is great, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Or you could turn to another letter by Paul over in Romans chapter 7 and verse 4. He talks about Christians being joined, or in the context, Christians being married to Christ. In the Corinthian letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2, Paul compares the church to a pure bride. Later in this book, Revelation chapter 21 and verse 9, and we will, Lord willing, get there, the bride or the church is the wife of the Lamb. Galatians chapter 4, verses 22 through 24, once again, female or womanly imagery is seen there. And John may have used female imagery to make a contrast. We're not there yet, but in Revelation chapter 17, we're going to read about that great harlot. That's a female. So perhaps in contrast to the great harlot, you've got this woman who has glory and splendor and honor, the one who's being looked at by God. And we can either be involved with this child, Christ, and his throne, or be involved with the way of the world, Revelation chapter 17, and die. Ivy, anything that you want to look at before we move down to verses 3 and 4?
Well, he talks about him ruling the earth with a rod of iron, and that comes out of Psalm 2. Thought y'all might pick up on that and may pick up on it again. But in Psalm 2, the kings of the earth are mad. The nations are in an uproar. People are mad, and they're upset against the Lord and his anointed. And
that anointed. If you will just hold that thought. Okay. That's going to get us down a little further. I was just thinking on 1 and 2. Anything there as far as the great sign, the woman and the child?
We talked about it morphing into the, we have the woman and we have the child and we have the church, the seed. And that is a little unwieldy for me. I'm a simpler guy than that. I said, well, maybe it morphs. Maybe it first of all is Israel, and then Mary delivers from Israel. And then Jesus is the church, the bride, and then his seed. And it goes on down that way. But I've come up with the thought that maybe it's simply the people of God. I'm not the only one that comes up with that. To me, it's seamless. The people of God is Israel. People of God is Mary, or the nation gives birth to Jesus, then the people of God, the church. And then the church is attacked by this terrible enemy again. And yet the church has victory. And that's the whole book of Revelation, the victory of Jesus and victory of Christ and his church over the devil. I think all three of us agree with that.
Yes, we do. Thank you so much. All right, Lonnie, let's go back to you as far as 3 and 4. Here we've got, John says, there's another sign in heaven. And Ivy did a good job as far as talking about the great red dragon, the horns and the heads and the diadems and the tail. So are there some things there for 3 and 4 that you want to discuss?
I just touched just a minute. First of all, I think what we see is in verse 1 and 2, we see the picture of Jesus coming into this world. Now, that's you may wonder how I get Jesus coming to this world, but that's in Revelation 12:5 says she bore a male child who was to rule all nations, and her child was called up to God and his throne. So it has to be Jesus.
Amen.
So she being with child, she cried out in labor to give birth, and then another sign. Okay, so we have a different sign here. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red, fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. Now, he had diadems on his head, and that is sovereignty also. He's king of the underworld, if you want to call it that. He's this is the devil. He is defined. Defined in 12:9, down in verse 9. He says, the great red dragon was cast out, the old serpent that is called the devil and Satan. So this is definitely the devil, the fiery red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. And we'll talk about 7 heads extensively later on. And so verse 4, I wanted to just mention to you a little bit. It says, and his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven. Now, what we have to remember in this particular part of this vision is that we are looking at a time prior to Christ being taken up to heaven to the throne. This is prior to. It's still in the time of Israel. And so as we put that, plant that in our thinking, says he drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Now, the third in Revelation is used as spiritual things. And so I think what we have here is that the devil, prior to the time that Jesus was caught up to God in his throne, had control of the destiny of the lives of men. The only way that could be changed was that Jesus would come to earth and he would die and he would forgive the sins of those who lived under there. So the devil had control over men. Stars of heaven, I think the stars of heaven, and I don't know that I can prove this and I don't want to have to, but in Revelation 1 says that God held the 7 stars in his hand. And I think Christians are God's people who he holds in his hands. And I think that the devil had control of God's people prior to Jesus ascending to his throne. And so that's the third of the stars of heaven, and he threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Well, obviously, the devil wanted to devour Christ as soon as he was born. I mean, even physically, that is that's correct. As Herod gave the command to go out and destroy the male children under 2 years old around that area. Now, so the devil was trying every way he could to destroy the man child, because if the man child completed his purpose on this earth, the devil was then destroyed. And so what we have in the picture in the first four verses here, I think, is a contrast between God's people and the devil trying to attack them, and the devil trying to stop Jesus from coming into this world. Okay, Brad.
All right. I'll say a little bit more about 3 and 4, and then we'll see if there's some things that Ivy wants to add. I don't use W.E. Vine's expository dictionary too often, but sometimes you find some real good nuggets in there. And in his entry for this word dragon, he talks about, and this is a quote, it denoted a mythical monster, a dragon, also a large serpent, so-called because of its keen power of sight. I find that to be an intriguing definition. And if that's correct, I think that is suggestive of the fact that Satan, as far as that keen power of sight, not so much that he actually needs to see, but perhaps that he's got really, really good insight as far as the ability to deceive people. He knows how to trap people. He knows how to tempt people. He's very, very good at what he does. In fact, you may remember in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14, Paul compared the devil to an angel of light. You have these images of power, 10 horns, 1 Samuel 2:10 might be a nice cross-reference for that, 7 heads, authority, rule. You can go back to Daniel 7:24 or move ahead a little bit to Revelation chapter 17 and verse 12. And then you've got Satan's 7 crowns or diadems, as some translations say. I'll let Ivy pick up on that if he wants to. And all of those descriptions, at least as I see them, are figurative descriptions for completeness or fullness. They've got a real strong parallel, perhaps, to Revelation chapter 17 and verse 3. They're telling us that Satan is not some kind of minority power. You may remember that back in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 28, you could go down to Matthew 12, 29 as well, plus Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15, Jesus said he'd come to break the power of the devil. In Colossians 2, Paul says that Satan's power had been decimated by Christ. Yet in spite of that, the devil is still so powerful, Jesus allows him to still be the god of this world. Paul said that in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. One commentator, Smalley, I don't agree with everything that he wrote, denominational commentator, he suggested that the image in Revelation chapter 12 describes the, this is a quote, secular self-aggrandizement, which seeks to usurp the justice and authority of God in the time and place that John was describing. And I believe that that is exactly right. The devil likes to set himself up as God, whether that front is the idol or whether it is something that's more or less direct, Satan wants to replace God. And isn't that what we see with the temptations that Jesus experienced? What was one of the final temptations that Jesus experienced from the devil? Fall down and do what? Worship me, recognize, admit that I am God, and receive a great blessing. As we move out of Revelation chapter 12, we're not doing that in this lesson, but in Revelation chapter 13, we're going to get more information about the devil. We're going to read about a beast in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 1. That beast comes out of the sea, and in Revelation 13 and verse 7, we're told that that beast is going to make war with the people of God. And then there's a second beast in Revelation 13 and verse 11. That's going to be the evil beast, which is from the earth, the land beast. And it's also going to do its best to make war against God's people. The devil has a kingdom. Now, if you don't believe that, you don't believe Jesus. Jesus specifically said in Matthew 12 and verse 26 that Satan has a kingdom, and the devil is using that kingdom to make war with God's people. Now, Ivy, he's done a superb job of this, Lonnie too, but if you try to look at the book of Revelation and make some things literal, you have some real problems. Imagine the devil having a literal tail, and he's able to reach up to the stars and pull a third of them down. Ivy pointed out how that would be millions and millions of stars, but wouldn't that also be millions and millions of miles to reach up, if at least if you're on the earth? So that would that's beyond comprehension, and certainly it's not literal. So when we think about the third part of the stars, just as the tail is not literal, the third part of the stars is not literal either. It's a way of saying that the devil is willing to go to great lengths to destroy God's plan, to destroy God's people. And that's what you find, isn't it? Go back to Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 8. Don't we read about the murder of two brothers there? Which was the one who died? Think about Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2. What's the devil doing when it's time for the flood? Stirring up people. So the hearts and the thoughts of people are evil. Good men are marrying bad women, or bad men are marrying good women. 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 11, you've got David. Saul's trying to kill him. 2 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 10, the royal seed is under attack. What about the book of Esther? Haman's plot to destroy the Jews. Matthew chapter 2 and verse 16, Herod has henchmen go out and try to destroy Jesus. Several young male children were destroyed. The devil is in the murderous business of destruction. When you look at his interactions with Jesus, you have not only what was referenced in Matthew chapter 11, but what about Matthew chapter 16, verses 21 through 23? Didn't Jesus say to Peter, "You're Satan, get behind me"? And then in Luke chapter 22 and verse 3, what do we find? Judas, he was entered by the devil. So you have the devil pictured by John in a way which is consistent with other things that we find in the New Testament and inconsistent with what we find in the world. The world jokes about the devil, sometimes makes him out to be something a little bit bigger than a munchkin, and they've got him sometimes wearing a red suit and carrying a pitchfork. If that's your view of the devil, it is the wrong view. This is a very powerful, this is a very serious creature who wants to do the maximum degree of harm to you and all of God's people. One source, Paulette, said, and I'm going to give you this quote because I like it. He said, "No other dragon was ever made to look so ridiculous. There he stands, great and ferocious, with the seven heads and 10 horns, before a woman who is helpless in the pains of childbirth. One would expect that he would lose no time in killing the mother before the child is born. But no, he must wait until she brings forth her child, a son, Jesus." Isaiah 9:6, Matthew 1:21. That must have been one of the bitterest pills which the devil had ever had to swallow. But there was even one worse to come for him. After the child was born, both the mother and the child escaped him. If you want to laugh at the devil, read Revelation chapter 12. And then he puts an exclamation mark in there. That is exactly right. I would go further, though. I would suggest that Satan's disappointment must have been even greater, because if you were to look at the original text, you'd find the word translated stood. It is expressed with a perfect tense, and that describes something that you are doing. For example, you think about a guard. The guard stood there. He was stationed there at a time, and he continued to stay at his post. The picture is that the devil was poised for a long time. He was waiting. He was watching. He was spending his time. He was spending his energy. He was spending his focus, waiting for the child to be born. Preparation was 100%, at least he thought it was, and then it was snatched away from him. Now, can you imagine how he'd feel? Can you imagine the anger? Can you imagine the wrath? Can you imagine the hate? After all of his well-planned efforts, all went down the tubes. I think if you consider what John says here, depending on how you understand a couple things, and there are some variations here, you can get the basic point. And one of the basic points is the devil is upset, and he does not forgive. He does not forget. Ivy, anything before we move down to 5 and 6?
You know, we put a lot of attention on the dragon. Let's talk about the woman again, whether it be Mary or whether it be Israel. The same thing, you know, that's how we got Jesus, okay? And that's what it's about. And see, I'm used to teaching this thing in one day. And so if I run a little ahead, you know, I appreciate you pulling me back and bring me back on that, because this thing is like teaching the 100-yard dash, you know, or 100-meter dash today, you know, in 6 weeks. We're gonna study that race in 6 weeks. No. We read the book. They read the book. They knew it. They had it. You didn't have to sit around and talk about it for 6 months. I've taught it 6 months. Well, that's wonderful, because you go into a whole lot more depth, but you don't get near what you get in the reading of the book and let it just kind of roll out and explain itself. That's my opinion on that. But I want to look at this woman for a minute, just so, like you did with the dragon. And I appreciate that very much, that we give that time that she was with child. This woman, it says, spirit in heaven and one are clothed with the sun. You ever try to look at the sun? And an eclipse even of the sun? It puts your eyes out. This woman, the sun is the backdrop to the woman. I mean, it's incredible. And huge, must be a huge picture. The moon is under her feet. You know, I mean, the sun is 93 million miles away, literally, you know, and there the moon's under. This is a huge, what, like the huge dragon? I mean, there we got something to compare with. Brandon, I appreciate you mentioning that. Yeah, thousands of millions of miles, you know, for all this to take place. Literally, it's not literal. But get the point of the depth of this thing. This is a great woman. This is the hero, or the heroine of the picture here, that is able to deliver this child, to bring forth the child, and bring forth 12 stars in her hair. You know, wait a minute. One star close would burn her to a crisp. People tried to make 144,000 literal, 1,000 year rain literal, all these other things literal, black helicopters literal. I mean, you know, with the locusts, all this. You know, folks, give it up. Let's get the picture here. This is like, to me, showing the Mona Lisa, swatch by swatch. Here's a little here and here's a little there. And no, you don't look at the Mona Lisa piece by piece. You stand back and look at the whole thing. You stand back and look at the book of Revelation, you know, God wins. The devil loses, and you got the heroes here and the heroines here, and of course the saints, the church. We're driving toward the church and the salvation of the church. It is a bride of Christ, and we're going to get into that later. So we can't tell all that story. We don't even know who the devil is yet. We hadn't jumped ahead. That's not even revealed to us. We don't know who's this terrible person trying to hurt this woman. Well, you know, we've jumped ahead. That's okay. So it's okay to jump ahead. And we went to 12:5. Lonnie did a great job of that, talking about that. So you know, use all of the book, and you can jump in and out of it and get back and forth. But it'll take you a long time to go through it this way, and that's okay. And you get a chance if you want to. I don't know. Writing questions or calling questions or sending questions. We talked about taking some of those on the air. If there's something that we need explained a little more thoroughly, we could do that.
Yeah, there's no perfect way to do it, but we will hopefully
have something. And I'm happy with this. I just say there's two different ways to do it, yes. And this is one way. Yeah.
All right, let's move down now to 5 and 6. And again, Lonnie, we'll turn that over to you as far as she being delivered of a son, the man child that Ivy emphasized to rule the nations, all the nations, with a rod of iron. The child's caught up into God, the throne. The woman flees into the wilderness. She's got this place prepared by God, and she's nourished there for 3.5 years.
Okay, thank you, Brad. The woman bore a male child, and that's what we've been talking about. And I think the pains of birth to be delivered. Certainly Israel, there was many trials and tribulations and pains that Israel endured as they went through time and to bring Christ into this world. And so I believe that is the woman is talking about Israel. And then it says she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Again, it's there's a little bit of contrast there. Anytime you see the word nations, plural, or all nations, then you're talking about the gospel age when Jesus is ruling all nations. And in the Old Testament, Moses, well, likeness of Christ as he stood on Mount Sinai to receive the law of Moses, that was one nation. But here the gospel is for all nations. Jesus brought that gospel into the world, and he brought it not just for one nation, but for all nations. And he said he would rule them with a rod of iron. Well, that's used a couple of places in Revelation. Let me take you to Psalms 2, verse 7 through 9. And this is a prophecy. It says, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today have I begotten thee. Okay, it's talking about Jesus. Ask me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. So this is really an answer. It's an answer to prophecy. It comes from prophecy, is that Jesus would be born and he would rule the nations with a rod of iron. Well, how does Jesus rule the nations today? Well, he rules the nations spiritually through the gospel. Well, is the gospel is the power of God, Romans 1:16, the power of God unto salvation. That's what we're looking at in Revelation. We're looking at the spiritual things, the spiritual aspects of men, how Jesus rules nations today. Well, he rules everything today. But the nation that follow him is the church. And it is ruled with a rod of iron. Well, what is a rod of iron? Well, I think just the characteristics of the rod and being iron, it says in the passage I read in Psalms there that it break into pieces everything. And that's obviously true. But the gospel is a rod of iron. The gospel will not bend. The gospel will not break. It will remain the same from the time that the apostles received the gospel on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 until Jesus comes again. It will never change. It is a rod of iron. And then this child then in verse 5 was caught up to God in his throne. Well, I don't think any of us can question that that is Jesus being called up to God in his throne. So what we have then here in these first few verses is a picture of Jesus, a picture of him coming through the nation of Israel, being born by Israel, and being caught up to his throne, and the devil trying everything he can do to prevent that, and which he was unsuccessful. So he was caught up to God in his throne. Then verse 6, and the woman. Now, the woman is the woman that was talked about in verse 1 there, which is transformed now because of Jesus Christ. This woman becomes the church. And I make a statement here, and you can think about it. You can question it, but you can think about it at least. The church consists of God's people. The nation of Israel was God's people, God's chosen people. They were God's chosen people in the Old Testament. Today, Christians are God's chosen people. But we're all going to be together in that same place in heaven because we're all God's chosen people. So when we're talking about the church, when we're talking about God's people, we're talking about people who have followed God throughout history, throughout the time. So this woman then that represents the church today fled into the wilderness. Now, this is, again, I think that the people who received this letter in the time of the writing of John, I think they interpreted it by going back to the Old Testament. I don't think they looked around and saw the things that were taking place around them. I think they interpreted it through the writings of the Old Testament. Now, as we think about fleeing into the wilderness, the first thing that comes to mind is that in the time of Moses, when Moses went to Sinai and received the law, they were headed directly to the land of Canaan, to their promised land. But they had to take the land. They sent the spies. The spies says, we can't take the land. So God, they spied out the land for 40 days. So he punished them 1 year for each day, 40 years. So the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared that God should feed her 1,260 days. So the wilderness is comparable to the spiritual wilderness that the church is in today. Now that's critical to understand a lot of Revelation. The Old Testament, the people went into a physical wilderness. They had all kinds of physical trials, temptations, and hardship. But today, the church is in a spiritual wilderness. On all sides of the church, there are all manners of sin and all manners of temptation. But those who are in the church are protected by God. Their sins are forgiven. So this woman, when God called up Jesus to the throne, this woman went into the wilderness, a spiritual wilderness, where she is tempted and where she is tormented and whatever, but she has a place prepared for by God where they he should feed her. Now, how did he feed the people in the Old Testament during the wilderness? He fed them on manna. Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. He's the manna. We are fed in the church today on spiritual manna, the word of God. So this woman, when Jesus was caught up to the throne, fled into a spiritual wilderness surrounded by sin, where she is the place prepared by God, where God will feed her until Jesus comes again. Now then, the 1,260 days, that's a hard thing, and we've talked about that before. But the question to ask here is, how long will God feed the church that's in the spiritual wilderness? Well, the obvious answer to that is he will feed her in that wilderness on his word until he comes back to get her and take her to heaven. So that church is in the spiritual wilderness of the world today being fed by God. And just look around. That's exactly what is happening. That's exactly where the church is today. We are in a spiritual wilderness and we are being fed by the word of God, and he will feed us until he comes back to get us. Okay, Brad.
All right. Thank you so much. I want to go back and just touch on a couple of the things here that jump out at me. When you think about Jesus, he is on the throne. More about that in just a minute. And John said he rules over all the nations. Well, if you were getting that in the first century, the first thing that would have come to your mind is Rome. Is he really ruling over Rome? And John says, yes. Now for us, old Rome is gone. But is it true that Jesus is still the ruler of the world? Matthew chapter 20, 18 through 20, Jesus came and said, all authority has been given unto me in heaven and earth, and he has not surrendered that authority. So as you look at problems in the world, people sometimes say, well, where is God? Is God is in control? Is God in control? And does God have truly a handle on things? Yes. Jesus was given that rule, and he has continued in that rule. So remember, as you think about the world, wherever you live, whatever is going on, Christ rules the nations, and he's got all authority. Now, why did John use a rod of iron as far as an analogy? It's always a little, I guess, dicey to read some things outside the Bible. And when you find people who talk about cultural things to say, okay, this definitely seems right, this doesn't seem right, or maybe this is possible. I'm going to put this in the maybe it's possible category. But there are some indications that ancient shepherds sometimes had rods which were at least partly made of iron. And if you had a rod which was made of iron, obviously, if you have to nudge a sheep a little bit, that could be quite effective. But also, and I recognize that some wood is hardwood, and it can certainly be effective in trying to deal with a predator. But if you have some iron mixed in with that rod, that certainly would take care of something if you had to, deal with a wolf or something like that, as far as giving it a crack in the skull. So whatever the image there is, whether it's completely wood or maybe there's some iron mixed into the imagery, once again, it is a reminder that that Christ has all authority. And Jesus uses that authority. Later in the book, Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11, we're going to find the word war. We are in a spiritual warfare. And that's always been true. When Paul wrote to the Ephesians, he talked about the armor that Christians have. The Christian needs to fight, Paul says. When you think about Christ and the warfare that he's involved with, another cross-reference that we'll get to a little later, Revelation chapter 16 and verse 10, John talks about a kingdom darkened. Different people have different beliefs on this, but if you go back and you study the Old Testament prophets, it seems to me that with the authority that God has, he is, well, righteousness exalts a nation, sin is a reproach to any people. That pretty much sums it up in my book. But Christ is able to darken kingdoms. He is able to bring judgment on people. He did that with ancient Rome. He can do that with America. If the world is still alive in 500 years, he will still have sufficient power to do that. When you look at Christ being caught up onto the throne, Daniel spoke of that, Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14, about 600 years earlier. Yet we have a lot of people now who believe that Christ will one day in the future return to this earth. And then at some future time, they think that Christ is going to set up his kingdom. If you get nothing else from this study, if you get nothing else from the videos that we put out on Revelation, Ivy's done a really good job as far as emphasizing this. I'm going to come at it a slightly different way. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 24. That is a verse that you need to know. 1 Corinthians 15, 24 says that when Jesus comes back at the end of time, he is not descending. He is not coming to set up his kingdom. He is coming to deliver up his kingdom. He is coming to hand over his kingdom. He is coming to surrender his kingdom. He is coming to say that here, Father, is the kingdom. I am no longer going to rule as I have been since he left the earth about 2,000 years ago. 1 Corinthians 24, and you can read down through verse 26. Jesus promised to establish his church about 2,000 years ago, Matthew 16 and verse 18. He promised to establish one church. He did that. On the day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, verses 38 through 47, the Lord added about 3,000 people to his church. He personally added them. Just like you find in John chapter 10, Jesus said, I'm the door, and people come in. That one that was born in Revelation chapter 12, he did everything that heaven intended for him to do. He ascended to the kingdom, and now Christ adds people personally to the church when they obey him. Christ's church has had many supporters, but it's also had many persecutors. And John knew that there were going to be persecutors. He had experienced some persecutors in the first century. That's why he was on that island. And that's why he talks about the church having to flee into the wilderness where God could nourish it. And I'm going to let the remarks by Lonnie suffice for that. You do find different people in the Old Testament having to flee and God protecting them. And he does that well now for the church. Ivy, some final thoughts from you before we shut it down.
I had two. Number one is, am I coming through okay there? Yeah. I don't hear much. All right. Again, the woman back to caught up to his throne. I want to ask a question. I never answered this question before to myself even. I didn't see it till now. It's interesting how new thoughts pop up in new studies. What throne are you talking about? Called to sit in his throne. I don't have the Greek here. I probably wouldn't get pulled out of it if I could there. I have to go to some references. Well, which throne is he talking about? His throne or the Lord's throne or the one throne? That's a good question because Revelation chapter 22, chapter 3 talks about his throne and the Father's throne and his throne. Simply in my throne, as I sit on my Father's throne. There are two thrones, and then we're sitting with him in the throne, and then we'll be able to sit with him in the throne too. Those who are Nike, those who overcome, those who conquer, that's a big throne. Is there one or two? Does it morph? I mean, I'd like to get you guys just a quick take on that. Have you studied that? Maybe we study it for next time. Then I've got one more point on the woman when we come back.
Well, the word thronos is the word that's used there. I just checked. So when I think about the throne of God and I think about heaven, I think about a spiritual dimension. Earthly imagery is used to describe that spiritual place. And for us, a king on a throne makes sense. We can visualize that. But I'm not sure that in heaven, my understanding is going to be that there is a literal throne there in the sense that there's just going to be one giant chair. But I think throne conveys that idea of rule and power and authority, immensity. Right. I mean, you think about the passages in Revelation, which talk about the sea. There was this sea. It's kind of like you have to, we talk about, boy, look at how far that is. And once you make that great trip, you can finally get to the monument or whatever that is. And that is my sense of, at least at this time, as far as what we're thinking. It's just vastness. And a power. You think once again about the lightnings and the thunders that are proceeding from the throne. And again, I think from our perspective, because of time and space, that helps us. But it is just that existence, if you will, of great glory and power and honor.
My question wasn't real precise. Whose throne? His or the Father's then? That's the question. I mean, it's not a literal throne. I understand that the power is the power. See, I see now in this what I haven't seen before. I think that Jesus was caught up, total victory. He's on his throne, which is the Father's throne also. There's a co-regency there, Brad. We get into that later. It's their throne, okay? But we're caught up with him in their throne. I think as Christ submitted the kingdom back to the Father, they still both are on the throne. He's reigning forever. The Father doesn't come off the throne. So I think that is a co-regency there is what I understand. But I was thinking maybe that's more that I see more in that than I used to. And when he says caught up to his throne, I checked the Greek on it, his throne, and Young says his throne, capital H. Would that be Jesus' throne as follow the pronoun? I don't know.
Well, this really goes far afield, but since we've got a couple extra minutes, I'll throw this out. I had somebody ask me about this. They said that they had talked about this, studied this, and they were having some problems with somebody. And they said, what's your take on it? I said, well, I wrote a commentary in 1 Corinthians, and I battled with that for a long time. But my thinking as far as the Godhead way back when is that what we think of as the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, now three are still one. But before creation, the oneness was, can I say, to a greater degree, the distinction that we see now was not maybe as pronounced. But there was that division where you've got the Father being the basically the creator. He's creating through Christ, John 1, Colossians 1. And then as you read about in Genesis chapter 1, the Spirit begins to move across the waters and help put things in together. And then you also find with redemption, the Father has his part, the Son has his part, the Spirit has his part. And I say all this to move us to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 28. Paul talks about the end. Christ has delivered up the kingdom, 1 Corinthians 15, 24. And then he says that God may be all in all. What does that mean? Well, I'm not sure in this life we're ever going to understand that, but it seems to suggest to me that whatever the state was prior to creation, 1 Corinthians 15, 28 is saying that we're going to see God go back to that state, if you will. Now, if that's correct, and I guess there are a couple of really big ifs there, that could have some bearing on the throne.
Lonnie, you got a take on that?
Oh, I don't know. Is
that total victory on his throne, the completed throne of Jesus? Is that what it's talking about? Well, I want a quick answer. Would he get a quick answer anyway?
I think the only thing we can say is that Jesus was called up to sit beside God at his right hand on his throne. I mean, it just shows the power of God in Christ. And I think they're on the throne. And if we take it like that, then they're on that throne together and they're both ruling there. And obviously the word of God, Christ came and did exactly what God told him to do. Therefore, he shares that throne with God today. Now, you know, there's just going to be some things that we're not going to totally understand. And maybe that's one of them.
Well, I think that's clearly possible. It could be his ultimate throne. That's my thinking.
What helps me a little bit there, Ivy and Lonnie, I think about the universe. The universe was created by God. So however we understand God, even if we try to put him in a space-time element, the universe is not a tiny description as far as God's vastness and glory. Now, I can't imagine a throne which could sit on top of the universe. I mean, you want to talk about a whopper chair, that would be it.
And I don't know, Brad, I don't know that we need to try to think about it like that. We live in a physical realm. We live in a spirit. We live in a physical realm today, a physical universe, a physical world, and we don't even know. We have no idea where this universe is. There are people now who are trying to teach that the universe is infinite. Well, it may be. If God wiped his hand and said it's that big and it's gone forever, then that's where it goes. We don't know anything about. We know a lot about how it's put together, but we haven't scratched the surface. But the thing that we need to understand in the God and his throne, we're talking about the spiritual realm. We're talking about God rules everything, but God is ruling in the spiritual realm today. That's where we as Christians are living. Our souls are living and abiding in a spiritual realm. Now, what is the spiritual realm? Okay, we understand the physical because we see it, feel it, touch it, but the spiritual realm we cannot understand. What if, just a little bit of what if this universe was a speck in the spiritual realm? What, you know, it may not be. I don't think there'll be anything physical when we get to heaven. I think it'll be spiritual.
Yes, it will. And if you try to put it in physical terms, think back to Revelation chapter 10 and verse 2. Remember that angel that had those two very big legs? I mean, that's just one angel. So again, right. That's why I say, I think if you try to look at this in terms of a chair, that might help the mind. But biblically, that's not the way to go.
Well, we went a wrong ways around that, guys.
It's all your fault.
Yeah. John said, I'll take what John said. We're going to be with him, wherever that is, Lonnie. We're going to be with him. That's enough for me. And he'll be ruling forever.
That's exactly right. And we'll be serving his throne.
That's all we need to know. One more thing. I did reserve one little thing.
One more point. Let me make one more point about that. And that is that we're serving that throne today.
That's right.
We are standing before the throne of God today as Christians. And that's how we need to. That's how we need to look at these things. We don't need to put them in a physical perspective.
Yeah. All right, Ivy, last item.
Well, Revelation 12:2, she cried out in labor or travail. This woman's doing a lot of work. Again, we skip over that a lot. We go pay attention to the dragon, all this. Here's what I get out of this. The labor. She labored. I talk about my wife going to the labor room. That's what we did in the old days. Went to the labor room. You go to the work room. You know, women don't work when they have a baby. They labor. This woman, whoever, Israel, was laboring. Israel brought forth labor pains. Like Lonnie pointed out, they tried to kill Jesus. The devil tried to kill all the babies, two years old and under, the male babies were killed, trying to get Jesus. They missed again. And all of this, they're trying to get Jesus. But she is laboring to bring forth this child. You know, women don't go to the workroom. Labor. When you labor, you hurt, you sweat, you bleed. And that's what it took to bring Jesus to the world. And he bled for us and brought us Calvary. So I think we need to appreciate what we've got in the church and the death of Jesus. Yeah, Mary didn't give that child. It's just a simple birth. It was a laboring birth. And that's how we come about. And then we are born again. And that's because of what Jesus did for us in his death, blood, and resurrection. That's my point.
That's our study, Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. Please join us next time. Thank you so much.